Hello, this is Russ Winter from the Techie Geek Podcast. Last evening, September 5th, 2012, Eric S. Raymond gave a 90-minute talk at the Central Philadelphia Linux User Group. I'm happy to present that recording to you now. Enjoy.
Tonight's speaker, Eric Raymond, talking about Linux. Yay!
Hello, everybody. Thanks for inviting me. And on the email list a couple hours ago, they asked me, what's the topic for tonight, Eric? And my reply was, topic? What topic? You shall all be dazed and confused at my disconnected brain eyes. So, warning, that's what you're in for. I don't really give talks with set subjects anymore because I prefer to kind of jam with my audience. I take questions at any time, and I may start with something to sort of seed the discussion and then just see where the audience wants to take that. There are a couple things I thought you might be interested in hearing about that I've been thinking about lately. One is, before I launch into this rant, I should find out, how many of you read my blog? Okay, only three people in the audience, so this won't be duplicative for too many of you. One thing I've been thinking about recently is I was having an RSC discussion with a friend of mine last week, and she was talking about fixing and changing some practices at a development shop she wanted to. They were doing custom hardware, you know, things like hearing aids and other assistive devices for special needs children. She was interviewing them, and she said she was appalled by the not exactly sloppy, but rather dated and inefficient practices that the software shop had. And she was asking me for advice on how you deal with situations where a vendor has given you a piece of software and you're expected to write control software. They've given you a piece of hardware, like a hearing aid, and you're expected to write control software for it, but the documentation is the kind of documentation that you usually get from vendors. Okay. Which is to say, scanty, ambiguous, and tending to stop exactly where things get interesting. Mm. So she said, what do you do about that situation other than, throw inputs at it and see how it responds? And I said, well, you have to do that, but the important thing not to do in that situation is to tangle the process of reverse engineering the device up with writing production software. If you try to do both things at once, bad things will happen. Here's the specific bad thing that will happen. You'll end up halfway to three-quarters of the way reverse engineering the device. But the things that you learn from it will get embodied in code in your application that you'll forever afterwards be terrified of changing because you won't know when changing it will break some undocumented assumption. This is not a recipe for happiness. In fact, it's a recipe for brittle, buggy software. And I said, the way you fix that is by writing down your assumptions about the hardware before you write the code. And I pointed her as an example of something I wrote a while back. A lot of you probably know I lead a project called GPSD, which is all about managing navigational sensors. One of the kinds of things that we manage are marine AIS radios, which are these specialized packet radios that they have on ships that broadcast where I'm going, how fast I'm going there, weather conditions, things like that. And the standards for AIS are, to say the least, opaque. They're scattered across six different documents written in impenetrable standards ease. And it is known that receivers and transmitters in the field don't behave exactly like the standards. So before trying to write a driver for this thing, I decided that what I was going to do was plunder all of the information on the net about how AIS is supposed to behave and how it actually behaves. And I ended up writing a document, which you can find on the web, called AIVDM AIVDO Protocol Decoding, which is all about what really happens in the real world when you listen to an AIS device. And I pointed her at this and I described it as a specification, but then I realized that there's a problem with calling a thing like this a specification. The problem is if you say specification to a programmer, often they're going to go from that to they're going to assume you're talking about the kind of stupid specification that you get in waterfall model jobs that's completely out of contact with reality. Whereas the point of a document like this is to be in contact with reality. So I came up with a better term for it, and this is what I posted about it. I called it a ground truth document. The difference between a ground truth document and a specification is that ground truth documents only describe what is. They talk about the present. They don't have plans in them. They don't have wishes in them. They don't have hopes. They don't have, this is what may be implemented next week or next year. They just describe what is, words and all. This is an invaluable technique when you are reverse engineering hardware. The first thing to do is write a ground truth document. Once you have that, then you start coding your actual controller monitoring interface. And of course, you know, you're going to find out more things as you refine the interface. But the point is, you should have a good idea of what that thing is doing that is well separated from any specifications, any hopes, dreams, or plans before you start writing production code. Later, I found out that there's a term for this in the construction industry. They talk about the difference between plans and as-built documents, which describe what was actually built. Not quite the same concept, but close. There's also a fairly close concept called an engineer's notebook, which if you are a certified engineer with a bond, you're actually required to be compliant, so that there's a record of your thoughts and calculations. That's not quite the same either, because that's a record of an individual person's thought, whereas a ground truth document is about a particular thing that people are analyzing, and it may have multiple contributors. In fact, in late stages, it often does. So the first thing I want to say is this is a good practice for you to do if you're not already doing it. I had several people respond on my blog and on Google Plus with, wow, finally, I have a name for something that I have done before and that was a good idea. Now we'll go to the second level of the instruction, which is culture hacking. By putting out the term and the concept of a ground truth document and how it differs from a specification, I gave programmers a slightly different way to think about their practice. And I gave them a way to advocate doing the kind of clean practice that is clear that they couldn't really describe before. This is culture hacking. And this is in the small, the sort of thing that the open source movement is in the large. So one of the things I wanted to put out there for you is that if you guys want to learn how to do that sort of thing, if any of you are aspiring culture hackers, start small. Find a practice that's good, that is valuable for software development and doesn't have a name, and give it one. So that's my first jumping off point for tonight. Anybody have any questions or comments about that?
Okay, you talked about specifications. Specifications and, to a certain extent, a number of standards are marketing concepts. They're really a mess in many ways. And sometimes they're contradictory. You know, they're just different, a committee where different people have different wishes on the committee.
And you are having a typical programmer's reaction to the term specification, which is why I didn't want to call this thing a specification. That's exactly why the term ground truth document is valuable.
Now, a good example, I think, of a project that's taken place is Samba. I think they've done a lot of ground truth.
Ground truth document, documentation of SMB. Yes, that is an excellent example. That's a very excellent.
Well, of course, this is a very old practice. My father, who was in military intelligence in World War II, was helping disassemble the first captured kamikaze plane. a Zero with a 500-pound bomb strapped to the bottom of it. And he had his engineer, his demolitions expert, had to, he went through the manual because he could read Japanese, and the demolitions expert then disassembled step by step the bomb, attempting to determine the ground truth of the kamikaze assembly.
Which is different from what was in the manual.
There was a very awkward moment in the reading, because formal Japanese uses the double negative in the opposite sense of informal Japanese.
Oh dear.
Don't turn opposite to left. Could be read one way or the other.
Oh dear. When you're disassembling a bomb, I can see where that would be an issue. Yes, indeed.
And at a certain point, my father's area of responsibility was done. And he said to his demolitions expert, if it's all the same to you, I'd like to just retire behind that wall over there to achieve a more comprehensive view of your excellence. And after the demolitions engineer had finished, he said, this is extremely interesting the way they put this together and so forth, and they're just using TNT for the explosive, which is quite risky. And my father said, how do you know it's TNT? And the guy said, by the taste, would you like a spoonful?
Right.
So, was it formal or informal?
I don't remember which way it went then, but he obviously got it right. Or I wouldn't be here.
That's a great story. Anything else about that? Someday you too may have to have a culture. This is how. Okay. Second topic, the perils of over-engineering. How many of you have used CIA, the notification service? How many of you know what it is? Wow, it doesn't seem to be well known here. CIA is actually a fairly nifty concept, but what you do is you can have a hook in a version control system for your project. And whenever you do a commit, the hook ships an RPC, XML RPC notification off to the CIA server, and the CIA server then takes the commit metadata and the message and makes a digest of it, and echoes that digest in an IRC channel of your choice. Mm-hmm. Why is this useful? Well, nowadays, email is so old school. Many projects nowadays have IRC channels where the developers hang out and talk about the development process in real time. And it's really useful if your project has an IRC channel to arrange that all the commit stream of the project is part of the conversation. So instead of, somebody says, there's a problem in module foo, and I think this is the way it can be fixed, I can be on that channel and say, I'm looking into it, and then I go off and I fix it and I do the commit, and instead of me having to say it's done, he sees the commit with the commit comment. This is great. And it's wonderful. I really like it. I use it on all the projects that I lead. Recently, however, I made the mistake of looking at how it's actually implemented. Oh boy. The more astute among you may be wondering why this kind of service goes through a central server at all. We'll get back to that point. I went and looked out at how it's implemented because one of the things about CIA is that it's notoriously flaky. It's prone to outages. It'll go down for a while and then it'll come back up and you get a flood of really old notifications showing up on your channel. Nobody's ever quite sure. Most people just live with it. I went and looked into it and it turns out that the implementation of CIA is horrifying. I mean, truly horrifying. It is a mixture that was, they started out coding it in a custom web framework, and then recoded most of it, but not all of it, in Twisted, and then changed their minds and recoded most, but not all of that, in Django.
Wow.
Three different web frameworks, doing slightly different, but somewhat overlapping tasks. I'm told by people who have looked at the code closely that the individual subsystems inside of Django and Twisted and the custom web framework aren't too bad, actually, but the interactions between them are messy and leaky. On top of that, the system is really complex. Some of the robots in it are written in, most of it's written in Python, but some of the robots that actually do the posting to IRC servers are written in Erlang. Okay. I mean, you know, not to say their language is necessarily a bad language, but it is kind of obscure and probably overkill for something like this. And anytime you get a mixture of languages on the project, there tend to be problems at the interfaces between them, and there certainly are here. And on top of that, the development practices were just plain sloppy. Like, I found out the person who is currently the maintainer of the software casually dropped on the channel the news that he had not bothered to actually sync the live instance back to the Google code repository that supposedly holds the code. So you can't check out the Google code repository and get a running instance. And somebody else had been wondering on the channel about this. What's going on here? I check out the Google code instance and it has syntax errors. Well, now you know why. There are fixes in the live interface that never got propagated back to the repository. Now, when I found this out, my hair stood on end and I more or less shamed the maintainer into fixing this. Well, or at least he claims he fixed it. Past performance doesn't give me a lot of confidence about this. So, okay, so it's a shambles. It's horrible. Beyond that, though, there are highly questionable things about the design. I think at least highly questionable from my point of view. One is the huge amount of code that is dedicated to making pretty reports that are visible on the web. You're a message relay service. Why do you think that the web wants to see detailed timelines of commits on every project? That's what the repositories are for. And why do you think it wants to see statistics on density of commits by particular authors? What's the need for this? What's the market for this? You're a message relay service. Where is all this Chrome coming from? Over-engineering is bad because, the implementation looks like code that has collapsed under its own weight. It's basically a rubble pile that's gradually shifting towards complete non-functionality. This is what happens when you overburden a project with features it doesn't really need. So I started thinking and saying, okay, starting from a clean sheet, how would I implement what CIA is doing? Oh, and by the way, one other problem with it, everything going through one server? Okay, hands up, anybody who sees what the problem with this is.
Your server is responding. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, we can generalize this. Single systems that have single points of critical failure, bad. Decentralization, multiple pathways, and robustness, good. As internet engineers, we are supposed to know this. However, we seem to occasionally forget. So I started thinking, how would you do this in a properly decentralized, properly lightweight way? And I started coding. So anybody want to guess approximately how many lines it took me to duplicate CIA's functionality of take the commit and relay it to an IRC server?
300.
1,000 lines?
Oh, that's way too high.
300.
400.
Very good. Very good. This project, which I call Berker, apparently clocks in at 361 lines of Python. Wow. Okay. This is compared to uncounted thousands of lines and cyclomatic complexity that would make your head explode in CIA. Now, I am not
telling you
this. What was that?
Should have called it MI7.
I might do that, yeah. I was mentally canvassing names of rival spy organizations.
KGB.
No, they're evil. I don't want their name on my stuff. It's obvious why I called it Berker. So I put out this story, you know, not to like make some claim about me like being a super wizard coder, because in fact this was not a very difficult job. Okay, right, once I knew what the program had to do, writing it and writing it to be that small wasn't difficult. The difficult part was adjusting my focus so that I honed in on what was actually necessary to do, as opposed to all the crummy crap that CIA is surrounded with. And I nearly went off course. I nearly fell off the wagon because there came a point at which I realized one of the things that really puzzled me was why XMLRPC? That's kind of heavyweight. Why are the clients for this thing shipping huge XMLRPC message to the server, which is then digesting it into the actual text that it ships to IRC? My first thought was, well, wait, why is the server doing the statistics gathering at all? There's a channel called commits where CIA dumps every commit that passes through it, so you're effectively seeing its entire data stream. So if you wanted to write something that does statistics gathering, my first thought was, why have that be in the transmission path at all? Why isn't it just a bot that's watching the commits channel? I mean, duh! You've already aggregated the stream, snoop it! On the output side, so you actually see reality. There's a theme developing here, isn't there? And then I realized, oh, wait a second, there's a problem with that. IRC has a 510 character message limit, which means that you can't send all of the commit metadata to a single IRC message line. Instead, the stats generators inside CIA are working on this full representation that they got from the XMLRPC object, and they're just sort of digesting that and shipping that to IRC. And when I realized that, I said, maybe XMLRPC made sense here after all. And I started sketching a design for another daemon, an auxiliary daemon, that would take the XMLRPC objects, do stats gathering, and then digest that and pass a request to my first daemon, which would do the actual IRC code posting. Better separation of function than CIA has right now. And then I slapped myself in the head and came to my senses. Because if you actually look at commits, you'll see at the stream as it goes by on the commits channel, you'll see that most commit messages are very short and touch very few files. Most of them will, in fact, fit inside the 510 character limit. And so I started thinking instead about reduction rules that could be used. What was that?
Is that why they have like a web interface to it for messages that are greater than the IRC limit?
And that's also why when you see a CIA notification, it typically has a URL at the end where you can go to see the full commit message. But I slapped myself in the head and I realized, no, I'm falling into the same trap as the CIA designers. The truth is, for most cases, you can drop out the file names and nobody will get hurt. And you can truncate the commit message to 510 bytes, and that's enough for human beings, especially if they have a pointer to the original commit in their repository. The point is, by deciding that it was okay not to handle the 1% case, I reduced the complexity of the entire system by a factor of 3 or 4, and that was probably a good trade-off. We need to be thinking about that more often. Sometimes there are things that you can do but should not. So this is my cautionary tale about the perils of over-engineering.
Actually, slogan, cut corners proudly.
Cut corners proudly, that's good. I like that. Where'd you get that from?
I don't remember, it'll come back to me.
Yeah. And when in doubt, use brute force. It was a fun dilemma to write. It's got I normally don't like threads because, well, synchronization problems. But this was a situation that like cried out for a producer and consumer threads and thread safe queues and co-routining, and it was kind of fun to write. So perils of over-engineering, if you ever find yourself in a situation where you've got custom web framework and Twisted and Django, and most of your code is pretty reports for web pages, something's gone badly wrong and you need to rethink.
I question whether that's really over-engineering. How did CIA start its life? Was it a bunch of student projects taped together?
I don't actually know. I don't get that impression. It seems to have been mostly
from the language mix makes it sound like that. What's
that?
The language mix makes it sound like it.
Yeah, maybe.
Was there one developer or three on it?
I believe there was one initially, a guy named Mike Adeli, who disappeared in 2007, apparently having been overwhelmed by the over complexity of what he had created.
I guess I'm still not sure about this. I mean, was the point of CIA to send notifications to IRC channels or to have the pretty reports? Because all you want to do is send notifications to IRC channels. I mean, it's a commit hook in your, you can write your favorite language.
No, it isn't.
Code, isn't it?
No, it isn't. And here's why. The reason it has to be a service daemon with persistent state is because the things you have to do to maintain state to an IRC session are not tremendously complex, but they're non-trivial. And if you open a session and send your message and then close a session to a server...
Oh, it looks like it's just joining and leaving.
Yeah, you're going to flood the channel with commit spam. And server ops don't like that. They'll ban you for doing stuff like that. So what the daemon is for is, and the way it works is, the way my implementation works is there's a listener socket. I apply for an IANA port number. There's a listener socket, and what it's watching for is JSON objects. I like JSON. And one attribute is the IRC URL, and the other attribute is the message. And internally, what it's doing is it's saying, basically, have we seen this destination server before? If not, we'll start a new internal robot thread to handle communications with this server. And at any given time, there are a bunch of parallel robot threads running, and their purpose is to minimize the amount of actual join-leave traffic to the set of channels that you're sending stuff to. That's why it has to be a persistent beam. Yeah?
Any recommendations for, like, say, an inherent application that's been overly engineered and refactoring isn't an option? How to approach it and kind of remove the over-engineering?
That depends entirely on the politics of your situation. There's not much advice I can give you that would be of a purely technical nature. It depends entirely on how many people are invested in that application and why. And generally, it's pretty frightening. I'm in a situation here where at least I can feel Erger as an alternative to CIA. And if the way I expect it to be deployed is that repository sites will start instances running, and then they'll make that port privately available to hooks from their repositories. So you may never actually see an instance of Erger that's publicly accessible, and in fact, maybe you shouldn't, because it would be a great way to spam IRC channels while masking your IP address. But the point is that multiple instances of this can be deployed, decentralization, yay, by different hosting sites, and each one of them will take a piece of the notification job, and that doesn't put me in direct political conflict with CIA people. And if the prospect of competition, there is a salvage group that is trying to fix the CIA code base. I've given them a little help. I'll probably give them a bit more. And this will have one or two outcomes. Either it will light a fire under the salvage group because they have competition and they'll actually fix the thing, in which case it's all good. Or the code will complete its collapse into rubble, at which point Erger will be an available alternative that's fairly easy to use, and that's good too.
We trying to get my attention.
Any other questions about this?
Yeah. What's stopping you from, like, well, I guess nothing's stopping you. But you were talking earlier about how CIA has this overcomplication with web interface and all these other goodies. Why not depend on other applications for that portion? Like, for instance, Track has a really nice hook into SVN and other versioning systems where they provide that interface for you, and so with the commit message you can just feed output a URL to the track web interface while not even worrying about having to format anything. So essentially, you're just...
How does that get you notification of the project or is it chill?
Well, no, I was saying for a more complete like commit message. I mean, if you have to cut it off for the message length.
Well, that's CIA already does that. In effect, one of the things that you give it in your XML RPC, one of the things you're supposed to give it when you generate a message is a browsable URL pointing at your source code at something like.
So it's not actually generating the. The web view of the repository?
No, just a pointer to where you can get a web view.
Okay, I misunderstood then.
But on the CIA site itself, it keeps all kinds of fairly useless statistics about the traffic that's passed through it. I think they're fairly useless anyway. The developers must have thought they were useful, but I don't know why. So that more or less comes to the end of my pre-prepared rant for the evening. There are a couple other things I can talk about. I designed my first hardware. That's a good story. I'll take questions. Ask me anything. ESR is here. Throw tomatoes, whatever.
To solicit your comments on the state of Android, given there's been a lot of activity, like the Apple Samsung lawsuit, which Apple won. But I read the other day that Android's getting 1.3 million activations per day.
Right.
And they said something like 7% of all humans on Earth will have an Android phone by the end of next year.
Oh, yeah. The fundamentals of the situation are don't get too distracted by the lawsuits. Because Apple is in a very defensive position right now. That's a difficult thing for a lot of people to process, given that they've got like the highest market cap company in the world. But they've got a problem. They are a single company that is trying to fend off competition that is coming at them from all directions. Because the Android army isn't one company and isn't tied to any one strategy, Android vendors as a whole can place a lot more different bets, can make a lot more different design tries than Apple can. And 95% of those design efforts can fail, but if even 5% of them serve Apple's market better than it does, Apple is toast. So that's why lawfare is essentially a defensive strategy in the long run. Can't really get an Apple anywhere. What Apple needs to do in the longer term is the same kind of sideways shift that took it out of computers into smartphones. It needs to go into a market that nobody else is competing with it in. And I don't know what that market is. I mean, if I did, maybe I'd be willing to start it. Don't cry for Android because there will not be a lawsuit. The fundamentals are still strongly in its favor. And those fundamentals are reflected in the fact that Android's market share relative to Apple continues to go up. It hasn't even moved. Next.
Yeah. What are the implications of open source for hacking democracy, given that the elections are obviously very much in the news right now?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Okay. There's a lot of political undercurrents to open source. Like at BossCon a couple of weeks ago, there were some people demonstrating a laptop-to-laptop communication system which can't be shut down by an Egyptian ministry. So there's a lot of interest in the political implications of open source in the open source community.
Yeah, you guys all know how I got my second death threat. I'll tell that story later. Okay. It's related.
Yeah, so... like there are various tools for looking at things like the voter ID, the photo voter ID law and so forth. And there are a lot of implications of open source for politics. Uh-huh. And then like, you know, so that was an open-ended, you know, comment on this if you feel like it question.
Well, I've been in the trenches myself. The way I got my second death threat was, I thought of this when you mentioned that, it was back in 2009, I was working with a group of activists that were supplying them covert communications channels through Tor and encrypted web server communication to the dissidents in Iran, and I was the above ground contact person. And I got a death threat from somebody who might have been an agent of the Iranian government. It felt like I was living in a cyberpunk novel for a couple weeks there. Shadowy global conspiracies of techno freedom activists, threats from fanatical assassins. It was fun, if rather nerve-wracking. Been there, done that. The way I think about this is that one of the effects of open source is to, the obvious and dumb thing to say would be democratize computing. But I want to put it more strongly than that and say anarchize computing.
Like P2P DNS?
Yeah, right. And the difference between democratizing computing and anarchizing computing is when you democratize something, you're implying collective mass action. But one of the beauties of open source is that it doesn't just empower the mob or the league, it empowers individuals to go out and do things they couldn't do before. And it gives them information leverage that could formerly only be wielded by corporations and governments. And that is the hopeful bottom line for a lot of this stuff. That because of the leverage we can get nowadays from technology and the internet, the advantage of being gathered up in a mob versus being an individual will lessen, and that will be a good thing.
That reminds me of forget the name of the application, but they're basically coined as the open source competition to Facebook. Where it was like,
Diaspora.
That's what reminds me of Diaspora.
And I wish them every bit of luck. I don't know how well they're doing, actually. How are they doing on their development course?
They're starting to open source them, so I think they've run out of funding. They just announced, I think, a week or two ago that they're going to be turning everything over to the community, including the code base for the sites and everything, and also policy management. It's going to be like a year-long transition or something, but they're trying to be pretty hands-off in the future, which is a cool thing, but it might be related to the fact that they don't find it successful.
Mm. It's fun to do that.
Whatever that's like.
I wonder if they could squeeze any money out of their Kickstarter.
That's how
they made their money. Yeah. That's how they got it. They had quadrupled what they asked for.
Oh, that's good.
All right, it's probably the 50% fall in Facebook stock that led the investors to get a little nervous.
Zuckerberg actually gave them quite a bit of money to get that started.
Really?
Funny.
He said he just thought it was a good project.
Ouch. Yeah, let's hope it wasn't Facebook stock. So next.
So in the election, I guess it was when George W. Bush won against whomever, there was a lot of discussion about electronic voting and hanging chads and all that kind of stuff, and there was a movement towards electronic voting, and I haven't really heard anything about it.
That's because it's a really bad idea.
Well, yeah, so comment, expand upon that and what the state of it is and the... whether it's going anywhere, whether it's actually in use and we should be worried, or whether it went nowhere and no one's using it.
The reason that electronic voting is in general a very bad idea is because the data that it renders is easy to untraceably mutate. There are ways to engineer around this problem. I've seen descriptions in the e-voting system in Brazil where it works like this. You vote electronically, and the voting machine prints out two copies of a receipt with a cryptographic signature on it. One of them is behind glass, you can't touch it. The other one drops into your hand. And the procedure is for you to check to make sure that the signatures on those receipts look identical. And then you take one receipt home. And later on, if they want to audit the vote, they go back to people and say, would you show us your receipts, people? And then they can cross-check the crypto codes on those against what's in the database. So with a sufficiently carefully designed system like that, you could do voting with decent verification. But so far, systems that are that well designed are very few and far between, and the ones that are in production use are crackable to a degree that deeply frightens me and everyone else who's looked at them. So as they're implemented today, you know, maybe that one exception in Brazil, bad idea, don't go there.
It's hard to imagine that is looking at working there. First of all, no one would say those people use those seats. And I mean, people don't even want census takers coming to their house. They want election monitors to come to inspect their seats. That would never work here.
Yeah. The tradition of secret ballot would foil that. However, the fact that you have choices. Yes.
Right, because this has
a hash.
Yeah. Okay. Right, and also it could be voluntary. They could just say, hey, if you voted at precinct 123,
right,
bring your receipts in, we're doing an audit.
And the thing
is, if you don't want to show up, you don't have to show up.
And the thing is, you don't have to get a complete set of all the receipts from a precinct in order to detect hanky panky. Above a certain density of retreats, any mess will show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The other thing is that the same system would allow a voter at home to go to a web page and punch in their
And verify that
their vote counted.
Oh. Good point.
Wow. Yes.
I haven't thought of that, but yes.
Well, that's actually a good idea.
Yeah.
So, can be done. Aside from that one example that I read about, hasn't been done.
There's a very deep objection to voting at home in that, for instance, women might want to vote without their husband knowing who they voted for, and they can't secure privacy from a home vote.
No, we're not talking about voting.
Right, no, I understand that. When I'm thinking about electronic voting in general, voting from home is very significant issues.
Well, how do you know the receipt you're getting actually records what you voted? How do you know that not everybody got exactly the same signature?
Well, that's an interesting question, for one thing. Part of the assurance in the system is the fact that you can see a duplicate of the same receipt that you get being printed, so you know that information is part of the record. The other thing you can do is compare the hash on your receipt against the person who left the polling station.
So you're seeing a running roll?
And if the machine's printing like the same hash for both, for every single person that votes, then you basically have 100% voter fraud and you don't get any chance.
Yeah. Right. That would be easy to detect.
Well, that's true.
And probably the hash would have as one of its components the time of the vote. Mm. So, yes.
Real fast comment. 50% of the human population that was in this country came to the top of this law, let alone vote.
Yes, but now we're talking about a different level of trouble. Not appropriate for discussion here. Yes?
I'm going to throw out a very divergent question. What do you think the current state of the free and open source movement is? Where are we right now, and where are we headed?
I hate that question.
I sound like somebody depressed, don't I? But you know, I'm thinking back to the old days of the Cathedral of the Bazaar, and you know, people were doing things at home, and you know, they were trying to write stuff better than Microsoft. And now things are getting so corporate, and you got Google.
Stop. Think about this. The most widely deployed, highest volume computer operating system on the planet is open source.
Android.
How it works. I'm thinking specifically in the Android area. But it is a fact of our current situation, it is an important fact with important implications, that the most widely deployed, highest volume computer operating system in existence is open source. That is a fact that matters. And whenever you find yourself pining for the good old days, contemplate the fact that the problems we have now are mostly the problems of success. And the problems of success are infinitely preferable to the problems of failure.
Does that statement include all versions of open source? That is embedded, that is fixed and controlled, or are we talking open source that is available for download to be used in a public environment? No problem.
The cell phone vendors have actually been fairly good about making their source trees available eventually. There's typically a delay of a few months, but we do get them.
Okay, so that's for the Android side of cell phone.
Yeah.
Similar to that, we're getting to the point now where we have people who are just users of open source and not hackers. I'm actually kind of drifting into that mode myself. It makes me fearful sometimes. Other than, the obvious support market growing, where is this maturity going to take us?
Your guess is as good as mine.
Where do you think?
Well, one thing that I personally have never lost sight of is that open source is really not because of our idealism, but in an important sense, in spite of it. We can have all the lofty goals and aims and plans in the world, but if it's the truth about human behavior that if the economic fundamentals don't favor you, what you're trying to do generally won't be sustainable and won't last. And the most important question that I asked 15 years ago and that I continued asking is, do the economic fundamentals of software development favor open source? And 15 years ago, I concluded that the answer was yes. And today, I still think the answer is yes. And that's why, despite occasional reverses, I continue to be confident that we're winning.
I'd like to comment real quick on basically, with the extreme growth in the user base, you also have a growth in the developer base. So with more people, you may, as far as the ratio goes of users versus developers developing open source, but since there's a wider array of people, there may be more numbers of developers as opposed to previous.
One thing that I think a lot of open source developers don't appreciate today is how freaking huge our culture has become relative to where it was in the memory of those of us who have been around for a while. I have been doing open source before it had a name for long enough that I can remember when most of the hackers in the United States would have fit in this room. Because in the 1970s, the culture was that small. Think about the fact that the hacker culture in its modern manifestation as open source, the open source community, has grown itself since the 1970s by easily four orders of magnitude, and that's kind of encouraging.
I have to disagree with you about that. I consider the Atlantic City 1972 convention. Couldn't have been anybody there in here.
Which convention are you speaking of? Whose convention?
There was a convention in Atlantic City where the show The Apple first. It was July of 76 in Atlantic City.
Well, possible we're talking about different populations.
No, but almost everybody was a hacker. There was no way to do a computer without hacking. There was no way, unless you were willing to spend millions of dollars.
Hackers, but not open source.
No, yeah, that's true, but...
Yeah, you're talking about...
We were talking open source.
when you're, I'm speaking of the hacker culture that was directly ancestral to today's open source movement.
Yeah, but most of, well, the claim was in 76, so everything was all hardware. People were giving away software.
Well, one reason I believe the culture was that small back then was how it was perfect. At that time, it was possible to be personally acquainted with pretty much everybody who mattered. It isn't anymore. Now, this is another thing that I was discussing with the same person that I was talking with when the ground truth doctrine concept came up. She was bothered by the fact that a lot of younger hackers, actually hackers her age, she's 28, she's bothered by the fact that the hackers she really respects are 15 years older than she is, and she's worried that the level of cluefulness among younger hackers is really terrible. And I was the person who had to say to her, it's always been like that. There's always a bell curve. The reason you think hackers were brighter back then is because of the selection effect. You are seeing the artifacts that survived. Mm-hmm. You're not seeing all the false starts and bad software.
This is why 19th century literature is such higher quality than 20th century literature.
Yes, the selection effect.
Yeah. I'm thinking about your point about incorrect factoring of a design.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful example of trying to do too many things in one design for World War II again, the flying tank. There was one actually built, and it flew very briefly. The problem was that the tank part of it kept it from flying well, and the flying part of it kept it from having enough armor to be significant.
So I recommend to all of you, if you can find it, there's a hilarious book called My Tank is Fight, Insane Super Weapons of World War II. Okay. And the guy who put this together, he just trawled the archives for all the completely nutso weapons concepts, some of which were built, some of which were half-built, some of which never existed except this.
That was good, though, because they had all this money, there was an emergency, they were saying, try anything, guys. You know, it's wide open. Anything, you know, we'll look at anything. We're desperate.
And there were things like the design for a super tank, a German super tank called the Maus, which would literally unable to go anywhere because it was so heavy it would crush the roads underneath. It never got built because that kind of like rolling super fortress, you just take it out with air power.
Or I wish there was a lot on the Russian front.
Yeah.
Right. Did they have the ship made out of ice in there?
The Pycrate ship? Yes.
Real extraordinary weapon, I think it was a little before World War II, was the circular battleship.
Yes, the pop-up. Yes, the pop-up. We could shoot equally badly in all directions.
Center, the battleship would begin to spin around.
it was called a Papa because it was the brainchild of this crazed Russian admiral named Papa. He had too much political pull for anyone to stop him. It was just nuts. Actually, the serious thing that I learned from that book that most interested me is that the Nazis actually had primitive but functional infrared vision equipment that they used for night controls, some of which was man-carryable and some of which was mounted on tanks. And they even had specialized vehicles that were infrared spotlights that could paint targets for the designators on their tanks. And the reason you all don't know about this is because that equipment was only deployed to the Eastern Front. Nobody ever saw it at the Normandy landings. Mm. So yeah, the Nazis had IR night vision equipment. Who knew? Okay. Anyway, that was fun. But next,
Would you be willing to say what your Linux distro of choice is and your desktop manager of choice?
Oh, that's kind of painful for me at the moment. I have been an Ubuntu user for some years, and I like it. I liked it because it minimized the amount of system administration I have to do, and I hate system administration. Unfortunately, I'm now kind of shopping for a new distro because of the horror from beyond space, the abomination, the gigantic glowing turd against Unity.
Can't you just replace it with your favorite window manager?
That, in fact, is what I have done. I'm running XFCE over Ubuntu. But there are various things about that where the integration isn't all that good. And there are some features I'm missing, such as removable media devices actually coming up as a file on the desktop. Doesn't seem to work reliably under XFCE. So I want a distribution that is not using Unity and is better integrated than Ubuntu is at the moment. Maybe they'll fix that problem, but I've been hearing good things about Mint. I might experiment with that.
What was the name of that book you were talking about, Tanks?
My tank is Fight.
Right. It's what?
My Fight. Tank is Fight.
F-I-G-H-T?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. Big Shackles, what was the first open source operating system where you provide the source code and compile it?
Well, that depends on some definitional questions. But some people would make the claim that some very old IBM operating systems had that property.
Yeah. What was that original question?
What was the first operating system where you could get your hands on the source and compile it and have a runnable instance?
What was the first one that somebody like us who didn't have a $1 million contract with an iron vendor?
That probably would have been the original Slackware distribution in 1993,
which is Linux.
Well, the original Unix.
How about BSD?
BSD, yeah.
So why is this an interesting question?
Because BSD dates back to 70 to the early 70s.
No, it's more complicated than that.
Yeah, I know it.
The early BSD tapes weren't actually runnable operating systems. They were patches on top of proprietary stuff. You couldn't actually run a BSD completely without any proprietary stuff until the Tahoe release, which was the early 90s.
I know 94 was when I had an early, early version of Linux running on my Amiga. So.
Wow. On an Amiga, that's impressive. Mm-hmm. Okay, next.
94, that's when I started using Linux, too.
Uh, 20 years. Yeah.
You told us about your second death threat. Is your first death threat interesting to tell?
Oh, not really. Some random jihadi. I didn't really take the first one very seriously, but the second one seemed a little more threatening. And in fact, I reported it to the FBI, and they took it seriously enough that the agent came out to interview me, sat at my kitchen table, and asked me questions. It turns out, mainly what they wanted to pump me for information about what was actually going on in Iran, because they didn't have any good intel there. I had to tell them, sorry, I can't help you. As a matter of operational security, I am avoiding learning anything about the Iranian end of our operation. I don't want to know, because what I don't know, I can't tell anyone. And not all people who want that information are as friendly as you, Mr. FBI agent. So, I never thought Mark's advice would be quite so practical. Yes.
Somebody on that same subject, somebody brought up at FOSCON, there was a presentation on mesh networking and ad hoc wireless and things like that. We were talking earlier about your desire to anarchize the internet. Do you believe that wireless ad hoc mesh networking is something that has a viable future? Do you believe that would be a reasonable way to anarchize the internet?
Yes, in fact, I do. there are various problems with it. Routing gets a lot more complicated in mesh potato land. And there's also a significant power distribution issue. How do you keep all these nodes powered up all the time? But yeah, that's a good direction for us to go in, I think. And there's a concept I ran into a couple of years back, which is just brilliant in its simplicity, and I'm so sad that I didn't think of it myself. You want to have mashed potatoes and you want to make them cheap? What do you think cell phones are for? Just buy up a bunch of used cell phones. And because the electronics is all there. All you have to do is come up with the right software load. Brilliant. I wish I'd thought of it. So, next. Yeah.
Just your recommendations for further reading, podcasting, vodcasting.
About what?
Hacking culture and keeping yourself in the game.
Actually, I read an interesting book on this topic recently. In a week, I'm going to go to a thing called CultureCon in New York, which is a conference on hacking cultures. It's organized by a guy named Daniel Messick, who is an agile coach. This is an occupation I didn't actually know existed until. What he does is he goes into corporations and teaches them how to implement agile development practices internally, so their software development can suck less. He's written a book called The Culture Game, which is about how to hack corporate cultures so that they can do this stuff. And he's organized a conference so that people can share ideas and techniques for changing the internal cultures of their corporations. They invited me to speak there. He invited me to speak. He said, how to become a hacker, as he described it, as foundational wisdom. And it's going to be interesting for me to be there, because what they're doing is, it's kind of looking like the open source, looking at the open source movement in a funhouse mirror. They're grappling with some of the same problems, but they're doing it in a completely different political context. And so one of the things I can recommend is Daniel Messick's book, The Culture Game. If you have any interest in agile development processes, go off and read that. It's kind of interesting.
One of the tools that reinforces hierarchy and rigid cultural structures is our educational system. How can we hack that?
It's not clear that we're going to have that, because it's in the process of collapsing under its own weight. But one of the bloggers I follow is Glenn Reynolds, a.k.a. Against the Pundit. Some of you may have heard of him. One of the continuing topics on his blog is what he calls the higher education bubble, and how it is bursting. There are some of the same problems at the K-12 level. And what he points out is that, what's the one paragraph version of this? Higher education has been undergoing intense cost inflation for the same reason that healthcare has been undergoing intense cost inflation, government subsidies. In the case of higher education, it's things like health grants and scholarship programs and that sort. The effect has been to decouple costs as they are perceived by the consumers of the education, the students and parents, from costs as they are perceived by the universities. And whenever you have a situation like that, the producers take advantage of it by gold-plating their product and wildly inflating their cost base. And what's happening now is this means that increasingly secondary education in the U.S. is increasingly available only to people who are willing to take out loans that will cripple them financially for life. And this is happening at the same time as the perceived value of college education is actually dropping. And Instapub has been pointing out for years that this is a classic picture of a bubble and that it's now bursting. So it's not clear that we have to hack the education system. It's in the process of, as Karl Marx would have put it, being destroyed by its own internal population.
But some alternative system needs to be built up before it collapses, or it will not have an option to switch over to the other tracks.
Oh, my, you are an optimist, aren't you?
iTunes University? iTunes University.
In fact, that's what's developing now. If you look at places like Khan Academy and some of what the University of Phoenix is doing, the more innovative for-profit universities are getting heavily into two things in particular. One is internet-mediated distance learning, and the other is reorganizing credit for courses around specific skill certs that you can then show employers, rather than, you know, generalized, I have a degree in English. And that's a good thing, because the skill certs are actually more reliable signals of what employers want than a Bachelor of Arts degree is these days.
But that just seems like the normal Penn continuing professional education, NYU, that, you know, they've always had, you know, skill track certificates.
Right.
And OpenCourseWare, you know, is just, you know,
so
the way I'm getting through.
One way to describe what's going on is that the scheduling and credentialing model that's been typical of continuing professional education is now increasingly encroaching on turf that used to belong to the universities.
There's actually some aggressive hacking going on inside some of the universities. I saw a long article about a Harvard professor who was depressed by the fact that his students typically didn't remember anything from his course 3 months later, unless they were actually using it. He was teaching a physics or something. And he and a number of other people have done this, have inverted the usual learning model to where he has the social part of learning happen in the classroom, and the reading and exercise happening outside of it. So you read the lecture notes before you go to class, and then you get into class and you talk with your fellow students, and TAs and so forth wander around helping you out. Because normally you've had like a lecture at the center, and then you talk to your friends outside of class. Now he's having a discussion in the center, and you do the reading and so forth outside.
It seems to me that would be very likely to work well for courses in which you combine the social aspect with an actual lab or practicum.
Right. And this is definitely only a couple of professors, but the motivation was precisely the fact that he was teaching physics, I think it was, and unless you were tracking physics, unless you were actually a physics student, you didn't remember what you took in physics for Pollock's. And he wanted to get memory going with you the next year.
Uh-huh.
And so he's now testing for that and looking at, actually, this is test-driven education, TDE, where he's looking for how well do different teaching methodologies lead to retention a year later.
Mm. Interesting.
Very different perspective. We're putting metrics on education, and that would be the core of a hack of education.
Because you can't optimize if you don't have a way to measure outcomes.
Yeah. And for physics, you did.
Yeah. It would be more difficult for some other subjects.
What?
Of course, most of those other subjects aren't much less valuable. okay, next. Have I exhausted everybody?
But the CIA was the pulmonary institute of America.
I actually don't know what they intended to stand for. I've never seen an expansion of that particular acronym. But this makes me think, maybe I should tell my story about hardware design. Yeah, okay, this is a good story about something that was sort of almost a culture. One of the things things I'm involved with these days is I'm part of a group of engineers that's fighting a phenomenon called buffer bloat. Have any of you heard of us this? Anybody? So I'll do a real quick summary. There is a problem at the foundation of the internet. All those dropouts that you're seeing in your videos, the crazy latency spikes, the inconsistent performance. Everybody thinks, oh, the pipes aren't fat enough. Probably not. Some of us have been doing some analysis, and we think that the actual problem is bad queuing strategies in the routers. They are over-buffered. And the effect of over-buffering is you have smooth traffic coming in one side of a router, and it gets turned into bursty traffic going out the other. Multiply this by a couple of different stages, and suddenly your internet is crazy chaotic with various segments of it swinging between zero utilization and 100% on really short timescales. This is not good. So we have been, and we think the thing that's required to fix this is basically reducing the size of a lot of buffers so congestion notification starts working again. I know that sounds counterintuitive, but that's how the analysis comes out. And also better management strategies for the buffers. So that's just sort of background. And I got recruited onto this effort by a guy named Dave Tott, who should be much better known than he is. He was one of the designers on the first home-based wireless router. He's done a lot of other cool stuff, too. And the specific problem he wanted me to solve for them was this. Right now, we don't actually have any way to check for and monitor and test for the existence of these buffer bloat latency spikes that we can rely on. The reason we don't have any way to monitor for this is that we don't have any reliable way to measure the statistical distribution of packet propagation times on the internet. Now, some of you are probably thinking, we don't. Sure we do. We've got routers and we've got clocks. Oh, stop right there. That's the problem. One of the effects of buffer bloat latency spikes and these wild swings between 100% and 0% utilization is that it breaks the symmetry assumptions on which NTP is based. We can't rely on our clocks. NTP is one of the services that's probably being screwed with. Okay. It means that in order to do network monitoring that will enable us to identify if we're actually having this kind of congestion, which is the first step, and where we're at it, which is the first step to fixing it, we need to be able to do network tomography with clock sources that are independent of NTP, which basically means we need a bunch of instrumented routers deployed all over the world, each one of which has something like an atomic clock hooked up to it, which all have a common time base, so that we can actually measure packet delays and not have potentially screwed up NTP corrupting our figures. And what Dave came to me, because he knows that I do a lot of work with GPSs, which among other things you can use as precision time sources, and he thought, maybe Eric can solve our problem, and our problem is that atomic clocks are really expensive. Your least expensive grade of atomic clock is a thing called a GPS-conditioned rubidium oscillator, which is just as expensive as it sounds. It's laboratory-grade equipment, and it's thousands of dollars a pop. And when you're talking about deploying hundreds of instrumented routers in insecure locations, you can't do that. It's too expensive. It's too risky. So he said, okay, what can we do for a cheap time source? And, I mean, GPS seemed like the obvious answer, but, okay, now we get into some good news, bad news situations. The good news is GPSs are cheap. The bad news is cheap GPSs only give you precision of time down to 1 second, which is a problem because the time scale of the events we want to monitor is 10 microseconds, that being the typical resolution on NTP clock time. The The good news is some GPSs can deliver time at 50 nanosecond precision because there's this thing called a 1 PPS pulse, which is emitted at the top of every GPS section, segment, which is precise to 50 nanoseconds. And that's more than good enough for doing network tomography when your typical feature size is 10 microseconds. The bad news is you can only get 1 PPS typically out of a GPS with a serial interface, that is RS-232, because typically the way you propagate that sucker out is by putting it on the ECE line and having the device driver on your host watching for an ECE pulse. And this is a problem because RS-232 interfaces are at this point almost dead, and it's very, very difficult to get your hands on a serial GPS that does this, that has 1 PPS coming out to that pin. So and when I got to that point, I started thinking, these days it's all USB GPSs, and those are the only ones that are cheap enough to plug into a router and be disposable at volumes of 100. So can I find a USB GPS that is somehow carrying out this 1 PPS pin where it can be seen? And I actually did find one. It was made by a small company called ZTI in Brittany, of all places. But I went to the North American distributor, and they wanted $900 a unit, which, besides being too expensive for our project, is just obscene, because I know the parts that go into those things. I know what's in a stock USB GPS, and it's $30 worth of parts, maximum. So that was just ridiculous. At that point, I started thinking, well, if I could, what's actually going on here? Let's actually look at the chip interfaces and see if there's anything we can do to get at this pulse. Does it have to be, I'm getting ahead of myself. The ground truth here, as it were, is that every GPS chip in the world has out pins that a couple of them are for the RS-232 interface that's delivering the sentences that you see if you look at the output. And another one of the pins will be 1 PPS. But in your typical modern cheap GPS design, you know what that 1 PPS pin is actually used for? The only thing it's used for? You know that LED on your GPS that pulses once per second? That pulse is accurate to 50 nanoseconds. Because it's being driven off the 1 PPS pin. In most GPSs, that's the only thing it's used for, which is kind of like using an F-16 to deliver a newspaper. So I started thinking, okay, we know that 1 PPS is coming out of all those chips. Is there any way that we can get at it for a USB interface? And then I looked at the pinout on your typical USB serial adapter, like a Prolific Logic 2303. That's the most common single pin. I see that's not. Some of you have dealt with these. And it turns out that the Prolific 2303 and chips like it have DCD in pins. The next thing, wait, it has DCD in pin? What is it actually doing with this information? And it turns out that what it's doing is it's setting an indication that the USB interface can see, aha, now we're getting somewhere, because that suggests that, let's say your USB interface is polling your USB, your USB hub is polling your USB device at 1 megahertz is typical. That means that I get to see the device and have it tell me if DCD has gone high once every millisecond. Sorry, once every microsecond. Once every microsecond. Is that good enough? Yes, that is good enough, actually. So if we could get the precision of our clock down to the typical polling interval on a USB device, that would be good enough. So let's see, what would happen? Let's look at the spec sheets and see what would happen if we just took your bog standard GPS device, which is a GPS chip with a 1 PPS pin and a couple other pins, hooked up to a USB serial interface on a tiny little circuit board and like carried out to a connector. What would happen if we just took those two pins that are currently hanging out there doing nothing except lighting up an LED? What would happen if we took the one PPS pin and hooked it up to the VCE pin on the other chip? And I looked at the spec sheets and said, you know, that actually looks like it might work. That actually looks like it might work. So then I went looking for a manufacturer, and I found one in Shenzhen, China, where there are all manner of OEM and ODM houses who would be delighted to take the specification that you give them for hardware and manufacture it for you. So I got in touch with these guys and said, look, here's what I'm trying to do, and I know that there's this GPS that you already make, and it's got a uBlock 6 chip in it, and it's got a PL2303 in it, and if you like connected these two pins on those things, good things would happen. And they said, that sounds really interesting. Let's try it. And they tried it, and it worked, and it's shipping. And the actual point of this story is that until the prototype arrived from Navilock in the mail a couple of months ago, I had never touched any of the hardware that was used to make this thing. This is the world we live in today, I actually managed to design a novel product, electronics product, by email with a bunch of guys in China, never having touched any physical hardware at all.
Isn't that cool? You don't need to learn Blender.
isn't that cool? If you think about it. We're living in William Gibson's time.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, it really is like that. And the only fly in the ointment is we don't actually have a retailer for them in the U.S. You can buy them one V100 for about $30 each if you order them from China. And actually, this is a device with a lot of uses because before this, you had cheap time sources that weren't very good. You only look out a second. Or you had these expensive laboratory-grade things. But now that we've got something that does this level of precision, there are lots of things you can do for it. You can do with it. One application that I didn't realize until after I designed the thing was there are a lot of places like oil refineries and military bases that do not want to have any ports open to the public at all. And they're really bothered by the fact that they have to have their NTP port open because they're afraid they might get cracked through it somehow. So one of the things you can do with these devices is you can sell these to people who run oil refineries and say, guess what? You can close your NTP port because you are now a tier one time source.
Charge them $1,500. Charge them $1,500.
Service contract.
Yeah.
So that in its way was kind of a nifty intangible culture act. I mean, who ever heard of designing hardware without actually touching hardware? Well, I think it was kind of
cool. What software do you need on the other side?
To talk to the device. Well, as it happens, GPSD will do the device that will do the thing just fine. Because what GPSD can do is it's capable of watching for the VCD high event. And then it turns that into an event which it passes to NTPE through shared memory. So that 50 nanosecond accuracy pulse gets directly translated into a queue for your NTPE, which can then use that information locally and also pass it on to other machines in the NTP cloud. So yeah, that part went. And actually, partly as a result of that, the guy who runs NTP has booted up a service organization called the Network Time Foundation. Mm. And he's actually asked the GPSD project to join it. We're talking about that now. Time source is going to become a more important application for us in the future, I think. So, any questions?
Yeah. Didn't you say I think you also mentioned this story at the Java.
I did, yes.
Wasn't there something about a national security implication or something?
Oh, yeah. There was a guy who said, wait, you gave this design to the Chinese? The state, the NSA is going to put you in jail, dude. And he actually claimed that that there are some people in the federal government who are so zealous about dual-use technologies that could be military that my one-wire patch could land me in jail. Fortunately, there have been no goons show up on my doorstep as yet. I'm not sure whether I should be more nervous about them or the Iranian assassins.
More nervous about them.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm actually thinking about this on the past what you're going to learn. And how much this problem of buffered spikes coming out of devices might be a router ecosystem problem. That if we have over 70% or however many it is, Cisco devices running and sending out this thing, how much of this is just going to come down to manufacturers issuing firmware patches
The buffer upload project has been pushing several different lines of attack, and one of them is some researchers affiliated with us have come up with a much better buffer management strategy that they call Coddle. And one of the stories in the last several months is we've actually succeeded in getting that into deployment at places like Cisco and Juniper. The big router manufacturers actually have a clue about this. The difficult politics is actually in a different place. Buffer bloat is politically loaded because the telecoms companies have for years been getting all kinds of regulatory preferences out of the theory that there isn't enough infrastructure, there aren't enough pipes, we have to get subsidies and regulatory exemptions and all kinds of preferential treatment because there aren't enough pipes and there isn't enough infrastructure and the congestion out there is the proof. And we are the guys that are coming along saying, no, actually, the build-out is done. All we have to do is fix the frickin' software. This is very threatening to a lot of telecoms people.
What's the line, never try to educate someone whose income is dependent on their ignorance?
Yes, exactly.
Where do you see video conferencing going?
Why do I care? Google Hangouts are kind of interesting, but they're more a stunt than anything else yet.
You're talking about time on the network,
Latency spikes are a big problem when you're trying to do video conferencing, obviously. So we'll fix, after we fix the buffer bloat problem, ask me again.
I heard that there's a blue and a red protocol that are getting into the kernel. Are they going to help, or?
Red is the name for one of the buffer management algorithms that's been out there forever. And it's actually a problem rather than a solution. The reason it's a problem is that in order to work properly, it has to be tuned. And most system administrators do not have the knowledge base to tune it properly, so they either just leave it on its defaults or turn it off for starters for nothing. The great virtue of the new tuning strategy, Coddle, is that it's completely self-tuning. So you can actually deploy it and then forget about it.
Is that the blue? Blue is the one that...
I don't know.
Okay. I thought there was one that didn't require tuning that's
coming out. That sounds like Coddle. It sounds like a
Coddle. Okay, maybe.
So, yeah, it's an interesting problem. And my Dave is actually coming to visit in about a week, and we're probably going to spend a week together working on what he calls the cosmic background buffer bloat detector, which is his thing to field a bunch of routers all over the world, each one of them with a copy of one of my devices plugged into a serial port. And the whole thing will be a real-time monitoring network that will be watching for how packet latencies buried. And if we actually have a serious buffer flow problem, which we think we do, it's going to show up on that network, and we're going to be able to make lots of pretty graphs that we can then show people and actually get them to move.
You don't have to worry about the protocols on the networks.
What was that?
Are you going to worry about the protocols on the networks?
I don't understand the question.
Protocols on the networks. You run on a network that's run primarily MPLS. You shouldn't have problems with video traffic.
I don't understand where you're going with that. What we're looking at.
If you run on a private network and you're running MPLS, you've got precedence for more of the packets. So they're going to go to certain buffers. You're going to go out first. You don't want to have precedence on that now.
Maybe. What we are looking at is specifically congestion effects of TCP/IP traffic, and those effects are generic to a lot of different physical transports. They're going to happen anywhere that you have, no matter how good the pipe is, they're going to happen anywhere that you have over buffering and poor queue management strategies. So the right answer isn't to say on MPLS you want to have a video conferencing problem. The responsive question is, on MPLS, are the buffer management strategies any better? And I don't know the answer to that question.
You getting ready for pizza?
Is it time for pizza? Should I stop? Oh my god! I'm very sorry. Let's go have pizza.
I gotta run.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that recording. I know I enjoyed being there. Please be sure to check out the show notes. You can also find links over at thetechiegeek.com. Again, thank you for listening and supporting HPR.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All BinRev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.